This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
American veterans and a disputed war.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush used this Veterans Day to strike back at critics of the war in Iraq. He accused some Democrats of trying to rewrite history with false charges. He said American troops deserve to know their leaders support the war they were sent to fight. On To the Point, we'll ask veterans these questions. With public support declining, how are they treated when they come home? Are they themselves skeptical about the mission they risked their lives for? Are medical and financial benefits commensurate with their sacrifice? On Reporter's Notebook later on, technology and medicine in the evolution of warfare itself. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. On this Veterans Day, American soldiers are returning from a war that is losing public support. We'll ask veterans how they're being treated, if they've become skeptical of their mission, and if they're getting the benefits they feel they deserve. On Reporter's Notebook, the changing nature of warfare since the first official holiday to memorialize American veterans. First is news update. Speaking in Pennsylvania today, President Bush said critics of the war in Iraq are making false charges and trying to rewrite history.
Some Democrats and anti-war critics are now claiming we manipulated the intelligence and misled the American people about why we went to war. These critics are fully aware that a bipartisan Senate investigation found no evidence of political pressure to change the intelligence community's judgments related to Iraq's weapons programs. They also know that intelligence agencies from around the world agreed with our assessment of Saddam Hussein.
Again, the president is making a lengthy and impassioned Veterans Day speech. Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, always good to have you on our program.
Warren, good to be with you again.
Is this, do you think, the beginning of a new, more aggressive strategy on the part of the president, or is it something comparable to what we've seen before?
No, it certainly is something new. In fact, one senior White House official just told me this morning that this was something where they've changed gears here. Previously, they've thought they didn't want to re-argue, re-litigate the case for war, but they've come back again to this because they feel the Democrats have taken this to a new level, and these are personal attacks that the Democrats are leveling against the president, and they can't afford to leave them out there unanswered.
Not just the president, but the vice president who laid the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns today at the Arlington National Cemetery. The president didn't say anything about him, but presumably he's very much on the president's mind.
Well, it's everything. They're all taking a hit. It obviously includes Karl Rove and the CIA leak question there. But most of these numbers are translating into worrisome figures for the White House because they're hurting the president personally. And the latest round of polls show steep declines in people's opinions of President Bush's honesty and whether his administration is at all ethical. So these are pretty fundamental questions of trust and leadership that they're facing right now.
Talking to Richard Wolff, the senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, have the Democrats already responded? This was pretty much telegraphed by the National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley when he spoke to reporters yesterday. Have we heard from the Democrats?
We have heard from the Democrats, absolutely. Senator Kennedy, in particular, who has leveled some of the most damaging charges, said that this is no time, Veterans Day is no time for a campaign-style rally. And I have to say that the president is adopting language that he used in the 2004 campaign. He even cited Senator Kerry liberally throughout his speech. That was no pun there. But he really wanted to try and revive some of the dynamics of last year by saying Democrats are undermining the troops. And by the way, many of them voted for the war. But Senator Kennedy, for his part, has already responded pretty forcefully, saying this isn't about the election, it's about the troops in Iraq right now.
So would we assume then that we'll see more of what appears to be, or what's being described by the Democrats as a campaign-style approach to the war in Iraq from the president for the rest of this year?
I think that's true, although what they're trying to gear up to here is the mid-December elections in Iraq, which the administration feels is going to be another promised turning point. We've had many of these before, but they really think that with the establishment of a more permanent government, that Americans will maybe start to see the end of the light at the end of the tunnel here. That's also slightly wishful thinking, because in fact, what the polls are really driven by is the kind of violence and the sense that the security situation isn't good enough for American troops to come home. It's not really about the politics anymore of Iraq.
One wonders how this will impact the president's effort to get an agenda passed by the Congress. Is he more focused now on the war itself and on his own legacy and his own image than he is on his domestic agenda?
Well, the two are linked, because they're seeing Republicans in Congress break with them on a whole range of issues, not just domestic, but also Republicans worried by the effect of the war in Iraq, and they've broken on things, for instance, like the treatment of detainees, where there's been a whole big dispute about, led by Senator McCain, about whether they can stop the use of harsh interrogation or torture on detainees. So there's a real rupture there on Republicans going into 2006. They've seen the results from places like Virginia this week, and people are worried on Capitol Hill about how close they can get to this president, whether he's a positive influence on their own reelection or a negative one. So there's no neat division here between domestic and foreign anymore.
So hard times for the White House are recognized today in this speech by the president.
Very much so. They feel this has got personal, and they've gone back to something that, frankly, the president enjoys doing and the White House is very well geared up for, which is to fight elections.
All right. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. As always, good to talk with you.
Thank you.
In a moment, American veterans and a disputed war on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're now back with To the Point. We're going to talk now with veterans on this Veterans Day. Paul Hackett has become one of America's most publicized veterans of the war in Iraq. As a major in the Marine Reserves of Ohio, he spent 7 months in Iraq, came home to run for Congress. In a special election last summer, he astounded the political world by running as a Democrat and getting 48% of the votes in a district President Bush carried in landslide proportions just a few months before. Hackett's now running for the United States Senate. As a full-throated critic of the reasons for war and the way that it's been conducted, he says he's always felt that way.
I'm not sure. I'll let the pundits prophesize on how my views have changed. I think my views have pretty much always been consistent, and that is that it was a bad idea to use the American military over there, number one. And once over there, they ought to fight the war to win. Which, after 2.5 years, it's pretty clear that this administration has no intention to fight the war to win. And therefore, they ought to bring the troops home and quit spending the money and the lives over there.
What do you think it means to veterans that public opinion about the war has changed the way it has?
I think in the military, we're somewhat torn, because we have this desire to serve our country in the military, and there's always that concern that if you are against the war, that therefore you are against the military. And I think this administration, the Bush administration, has done a pretty good job of equating the two, and I like to differentiate the two, and I think it's very easy to be supportive of the military and their families and the tough jobs that they do, but not support the administration that misuses the military. And I think that all of us in the military, to some extent, grapple with our concern over how the military has been used and also doing our job on a daily basis in the military.
How do you think the administration should change its behavior in Iraq? You've said several times that you think that it was okay to go to Iraq, but that it has been poorly handled. Am I correct in that?
I was going to jump in there. No, I mean, I was adamantly opposed to the use of the military in Iraq because what we're doing there and what we've been doing there for essentially 2.5 years is nation building.
So you were opposed to Iraq before you even went there?
Correct. And the nation building that that's taking place over there is not like the nation building that took place in Europe after World War II, where we were reconstructing well-established democratic-type governments. I mean, we are building from scratch a form of government that is completely new to that culture, and it is complete political hubris to believe that we will go in there, create a democratic government, and that somehow or another that will spread throughout the region. And we've been there coming on 3 years, and there has been no objective success in that 3 years. The security situation is far worse today than it was a year ago when I got there. It's worse today than it was 3 years ago when we first got there. The infrastructure has deteriorated substantially since we've been there, and it has been a complete, absolute failure of foreign policy, and it's exhausting not only our military might but our political capital throughout the world.
When you're publicly critical of the war, as you have been, or the conduct of the war, do people ever say that you're unpatriotic?
I've heard that. I heard it on. I heard it certainly more frequently in the congressional race, and I don't really tolerate it. You know, it's just nonsense. I typically hear that from overweight, middle-aged guys who never served in the military. Most notably represented by guys like Rush Limbaugh. Who were unwilling to serve in the military. And look, I went and fought over in Iraq, not to come home and be told that I can't have my freedoms. And political dissent and free expression is the cornerstone to American freedoms. And I'll be damned if I'll have somebody tell me that I can't speak my mind politically or otherwise in the United States.
What about your service? You were in Fallujah at one point, as I understand it. What'd you see there? What'd you do?
I was in Fallujah, actually, a year ago today. I'd been there for a couple of weeks. The invasion kicked off on, if I remember correctly, on the 8th of November, 2004. I ran a civil affairs operation at the eastern entry point to the city at a place called the Fallujah Liaison Team, and I did everything from delivering humanitarian assistance to, my other job 24/7 was defending the base. And I did humanitarian assistance. I coordinated entry into the city for the reconstruction that took place after the invasion. And I did site surveys. I picked up dead bodies. I took receipt of dead bodies that many of the fighting forces didn't know what to do with.
When you say dead bodies, were they dead bodies of civilian Iraqis, of people on the other side, or American troops?
Insurgent fighters and also Iraqi civilians.
Did that give you some pain?
No, I think, we probably, for myself, I just looked at it pretty dispassionately. It's just part of the job. Somebody's got to do it, and that was my day to do it as part of civil affairs.
You saw a lot of death. Did you ever have to kill?
I don't think it's anything anybody who's been over there likes to talk about either way. So, I mean, it's part of the program over there. It's just,
That was Paul Hackett, attorney and Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. We recorded that interview yesterday with him. He served as a major in the Marine Corps Reserve, served a seven-month tour of duty in Iraq. With us live now on our program is Christopher Bain. He's a staff sergeant with the 1st Armored Division of the U.S. Army, served for 13 years until he was disabled in combat in Iraq 19 months ago. He's now an outpatient at the Walter Reed Hospital, lives across the barracks opposite the hospital, sees his family on weekends. Sergeant Bain, we're delighted to have you with us, and thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
How do you feel about what we just heard from Paul Hackett, that he says it was a bad idea from the beginning to go into Iraq? Security there is worse than it was when we began. There's been no success. We ought to bring the troops home.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank him for his service and what he's done over there and being a Marine. Everybody knows once a Marine, always a Marine. And me being in the United States Army, we've always had our own opinions and fought against each other. But ever since this war, our coalition, our family, basically all the branches, we've all gotten together and we're fighting as one, as really one branch, as just armed services. And can't really say I'm in the Army because we're all working from shoulder to shoulder and from left to right.
I should say that that's the spirit of Veterans Day, too, which is now called Veterans Day, in recognition of the fact that people from all the services have sacrificed in the way that you and others have. Go ahead. I'm interested in your take on this criticism of the war coming from your fellow veteran, Marine former Major Paul Hackett.
Yes, sir. I know he's a Democrat, and I'm a Republican, but being in the military, they always say that's a conflict of interest because you're not supposed to have any politics in you. But that's just a part of life and part of being American and having freedom. So that's the reason we do what we do, so we can stay free and have a free and have democracy. And he has his opinions and I have mine, and I disagree with a lot of his opinions. I did hear what he had to say, and I respect a lot of his input, but also at the same time we also did two different missions. I was a chemical biological warfare guy in combat arms, and he's a civil affairs. He does a lot of the helping with the government, and he does help take a lot of the bodies that are found and has to dispose of them properly. And basically, what I did is go out and seek and destroy. My whole job is to seek and destroy chemical warfare, or if there is no chemical warfare out there, basically I would go out and patrol, because I have the combat arms experience, and I'd go out and patrol and basically help train their army, Iraqi National Guard, or just go out and basically keep the peace and talk to the kids and teach them what democracy is about, not just democratically and not republicanly. What we're trying to do is show them what democracy is all about, what freedom and the great things of being free. I mean, there's a great example I can give you. I escorted a few of the Iraqi women to a grocery store to go shopping, and when we went shopping, I mean, and I'll use this as a primary example. They going down an aisle. I didn't know what tribe they were. If they were Sunni or any of the other two or three different tribes they have out there. But basically, I could care less what their tribe was. To me, she's a Iraqi citizen. She's a female, and I'm going to treat her with all the respect I do, just like the American women. And she was going down the aisle. And she was looking at the, I'll say bread. She was looking at some bread, and all you could see was white bread. So I'm like, geez, don't they have any wheat bread there? Because, well, I mean, I love white bread myself, but she was, so basically she goes, well, can I try the wheat bread? And I said, well, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to teach you guys. And she goes, well, I'm only allowed to eat white bread, so I can't buy wheat bread. I'm not allowed to. I said, well, once everything changes, you can try the wheat bread. You can go and buy it. And she goes, well, what if I don't like it? I said, well, then give it to your neighbor or throw it away. She goes, well, I can't do that. I said, well, why not? She goes, well, because that would be against the rules and that would be against the laws. And I said, well, that's what the laws used to be. Now you can do whatever you want with your own money, and at least you obey by the laws that you create, because we're not creating them, we're just helping them.
Let me ask you this, Sergeant, if I may. How did you lose your arm, and would you go back to Iraq if you had the opportunity?
I've been here for 19 months, and I didn't lose my left arm. I almost lost it. I opted for an experimental surgery, and they did about 8 surgeries on my arm, and I got to keep it. And I'm doing really good. And since I've been here 19 months, I mean, I was done with all my therapy and everything probably in 13, 14, maybe 15 months. And I've been here trying to fight to actually go back over in country.
So you want to go back?
I think we're doing a great job there, and I think it's getting better and better. And I said, well, and people always if you watch the news all the time, I always say, you know, I can't even watch the news anymore. It just it upsets me, and I get mad because they're mostly reporting negative input, and they're just putting up the body count. And that's not what we're doing. We're not going over there and just killing and dying. We're going over there and we're teaching these kids, the new generation in that country, what democracy is about, and we're educating them. We're building schools, and we're doing so many great things. I mean, there's American teachers that are volunteer to go over there and teach a new curriculum, and I think that is excellent, that they're going to learn their history, where they came from, and where we come from, and what democracy and freedom is all about.
So you think that's what the war is about, then? It is about teaching Iraqis about American-style values and imposing or allowing democracy to take place there? Is that what you're saying?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. Are you saying, then, that the war is about teaching Iraq about democracy? Is that what we're doing?
Well, that's not what it's about, but we are teaching those things. But also the war... When we went over there, we initially went over there to fight on terrorism, and we are fighting on terrorism. I mean, I always believe things are going to happen, and once things are situated over in Iraq, it might take a couple more years. I don't think it's going to take much longer, but I mean, probably 5 years tops. We'll be over there for a little bit more, and that's a long term goal, and I don't think that's going to happen. But if it does, so be it.
All right. Once again, Staff Sergeant Chris Bain with the 1st Armored Division lost the use of his arm, feels nonetheless that he would like to return to Iraq and that we're doing a good job there. Dramatic contrast to our earlier guest, to Paul Hackett, attorney, Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate, who said he opposed the war in Iraq from the beginning. We'll come back and talk more with other veterans, particularly about the veterans benefits programs on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Once again, on this Veterans Day, we're talking to veterans about the way they feel about the war in Iraq. This on the day that President Bush lashed out at his critics and said that troops, including veterans, deserve to know that their elected leaders who voted to send them to war continue to stand behind them. That, of course, a swipe at Democrats who supported the war in the outset by the vote in the Senate, but who have now been very critical of the way that it has been handled. Paul Rykoff is founder and executive director of Operation Truth, which describes itself as the largest nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy organization representing veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. He was a member of the National Guard, led an infantry platoon in Baghdad for a year, and returned home in the spring of last year. Paul Rykoff, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you.
You have a statement on your website today that appears to be very critical of the Department of Veterans Affairs in particular, and Secretary Jim Nicholson of Veterans Affairs in particular as well. Tell us your concerns.
Well, with regard to the VA, I think the bottom line is that the VA and the administration is not doing enough. There's a lot of talk in Washington and around this country that folks support the troops, but year after year, the VA is woefully underfunded, and that's in part because the funding is at the discretion of the Congress and the President. There's no mandatory baseline funding for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the result is that the agency charged with veteran care has been continuously underfunded by as much as 14%, and that's according to the agency's own undersecretary. They don't have enough centers and personnel and counselors and paper pushers to properly screen and treat our returning veterans. Over a million folks have gone through Iraq and Afghanistan. Roughly one in five will come home, sometimes one in four, with post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental health issues. And some Iraq veterans are already homeless. The bottom line is that they're not doing enough. And for many of these folks, they're in Baghdad one week and in Brooklyn or Bethesda the next week. And there's not a system in place that's ready to receive them.
We just heard from Chris Bain, who's at the Walter Reed Army Hospital and is among those who have apparently, he said he was the beneficiary of experimental surgery to repair his arm, which he said he almost lost, but does now still have. How does that reconcile, or how do you reconcile that kind of thing, and so we've seen so much of that, with what you just said about the general situation of veterans?
Sure. Well, what we've seen with situations like his is that the care, especially the immediate care and the initial care at places like Bethesda and Walter Reed is generally good, but they're often falling under the Department of Defense. Once they leave those centers and go over to the VA, there's a significant drop-off. And right now, the most estimates say the VA needs billions. There's a wave of new veterans coming, and the VA is not ready. And Secretary Jim Nicholson crawled to Congress with his tail between his legs a few months ago to admit that the agency had miscalculated their needs by almost $3 billion for the next 2 years. And no one's been held accountable for this foul-up. The agency needs to keep a closer eye on these developing needs, and they need to project for the future. We've seen that the administration so far underestimated the number of troops we need in Iraq. They underestimated the amount of body armor we need. And I'll tell you overall that they've underestimated the human cost that will overwhelm the VA if they don't make necessary changes to accommodate that wave.
Overwhelm the VA. What do you predict for the future if, in fact, the underfunding you're describing continues?
Well, we've already seen veterans waiting at least 6 months, often 8 months, sometimes up to a year for their claims to be processed, and sometimes they are amputees, people with severe head wounds. And these are all over the country. We've got veterans in all 50 states, Puerto Rico and Guam. And we haven't even really gotten into the true human mental toll that could start to filter out over the next few years. Only about 100,000 vets have gone for health care so far at the VA, out of 370,000 that are eligible, that have returned and discharged. So you should expect that another significant percentage of that 370,000 people will seek VA care at some point in the next couple years. And really, the White House has underestimated that mental cost, especially. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, if untreated, can result in criminal problems, can result in homelessness, marital problems, suicide, a lot of the same problems we saw after Vietnam. And unfortunately, we haven't learned many of the lessons of Vietnam. We need a serious commitment to our veterans, and we need some leadership from the White House to make that happen.
Paul Rieckhoff, again, founder, executive director of Operation Truth. Chuck Larson has founded another group, which is called United for Our Troops. He also serving as a state senator in Iowa. He, too, is a veteran, major in the Army Reserves with the 372nd Engineer Group, spent a year in Iraq, as did Paul Rieckhoff. Chuck Larson, Major Larson, Senator Larson, I guess I should say, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
What do you say to what Paul Rieckhoff says about underfunding of veterans' benefits and the possible consequences of that?
I think I'd first like to step back to something Paul Hackett said, which I think is very unfortunate. If you remember a few minutes ago when he was being interviewed, he said he was opposed to the war before he even left to go fight there. And it surprised me. I was just looking at his website, and on his website he said that I recently returned from Iraq as a major in the U.S. Marine Corps. I'd been honorably discharged from the Corps in 1999, but I couldn't just sit by and watch what was happening over there when I knew I could help. So I volunteered to go. After I'd been in Iraq for 2 months, I volunteered again, this time to go to Fallujah. Religious fanatics and insurgents had seized the city. They had to be stopped. A civil government had to be restored. Now, that is dramatically different than what he just said on the radio. And I think it speaks to the fact that he's a Democrat candidate running for office, and that's why he's now taking this bent on the issue.
Okay. He's not here to respond. As I indicated, that interview with him was recorded yesterday. Let me ask you what you think now about what Paul Rykoff just said about veterans' benefits.
Well, I would disagree. I have yet to see a veteran who's been turned away from the VA. They do an outstanding job to help individuals, and all veterans returning to the United States receive a tremendous amount of support through the base that they're returning. They're given all of the telephone numbers for VA outreach in case there is assistance that's needed a month or 2 months or 3 months upon their return. And it does take several months to readjust to America after having been in the combat zone. And so a soldier may need to reach out on down the road, and that's why the VA is there and available.
Again, our earlier guest, Paul Rykoff, said that Secretary Nicholson of Veterans Affairs says that the agency miscalculated its need by almost $3 billion over the next 2 years. Mr. Rykoff says the administration hasn't done anything about that.
Again, I have yet to see a veteran that has not been assisted.
Paul Rykoff, comment on that?
Well, I'd invite the gentleman to come to our office in New York or talk with the hundreds of veterans around the country who we're in contact with who have been turned away at the VA or have been undertreated at the VA. And I've got to make a point here. You've got politicians from both sides of the aisle here. You've got Republicans and Democrats. And we're a nonpartisan educational center and an advocacy group that's interested in focusing on solutions. And oftentimes these veteran issues are thrown back and forth like a political football. But let me tell you one thing. The VFW, the American Legion, the Disabled American Veterans, every major veterans group in the country has supported mandatory funding of the VA and has been outspoken on these issues. So I think if you do your homework and really dig around, you'll see that there's not being a real initiative set forward to truly take care of our veterans. We're doing some stuff that's true, and people are getting care, but it's not enough.
Senator Larson, would you support the mandatory funding?
Paul, let me just say this. I work as a state senator in Iowa. I work with veterans every single day in contact with them. I have yet to receive a single phone call saying that the VA has not done enough or that it's let a veteran fall through the cracks. I know the employees at the VA. They're outstanding individuals. They bend over backwards to do everything they can to take care of our men and women in uniform.
Paul Rykoff, back to you. In your statement on the web today, you ask these questions. Were we misled into war? Does anyone have a real plan for Iraq? What's the basis of those questions?
Well, I think that those are questions that need to be answered in the continuing ongoing conversation about the war. A big part of what our organization does is amplify the voices of troops and veterans and propel them into the political conversation to try to shine a spotlight on this type of political football that goes back and forth. I think those of us who fought in Iraq deserve to know why we became veterans in the first place. Instead of partisan bickering back and forth over who said what in Washington, on today of all days, there should be a consensus on the need for real investigations into the deadly shortcomings of the pre-war planning. It's unfortunate that the president doesn't think that he owes that to the people who've been unwavering in their bravery for carrying out his plans. And you know, we don't know what happened. The Republicans and Democrats seem to be going back and forth, and I think the way to get to the bottom of it is to call for investigations, and I think that the veterans of this war deserve that.
Chuck Larson, again, you are now a U.S. senator, excuse me, a state senator in Iowa. What is your attitude toward partisan politics, and how did your experience in Iraq affect that?
Well, one, I would disagree with Paul. I think there is a game plan in Iraq right now, and that is to help the government stand up so it can stand against the enemy and be a free democracy. Just about 10 days ago, there was an article in the paper that the U.S. had turned over 27 bases to the people of Iraq. That was not the significant issue. The significant issue buried in that article was the fact that the city of Najaf is now under 100% control of the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force. If you remember a year ago, that city was uncontrollable. That's where Muqtada al-Sadr was holed up in a mosque. And so that's a tremendous step forward. Four sectors in Baghdad, 100% Iraqi control now. The city of Tikrit, 100% under the control of the Iraqi army and police force. So city by city, region by region, as the Iraqi government is able to stand up and take over and manage their affairs, it will be turned back over to them. And I believe that that's the exit strategy.
What about partisan politics in the United States?
I think it's very unfortunate. I think our men and women have done an outstanding job in Iraq. We've had more men and women in the Middle East vote in free and fair fair elections than in the last 6,000 years, and yet sadly that isn't reported. We've made great progress, and we need to stay the course and complete the mission.
Chuck Larson, once again, state senator in Iowa, founder of United for Our Troops, whose mission is to get out the good news about what's going on in Iraq. Back to Paul Rykoff with Operation Truth. Again, you're asking some fairly pointed questions, although you are a nonpartisan group. How have you been treated by Americans whose, according to the polls, whose support for the war seems to be declining?
Well, I think, thankfully, most Americans have learned their lesson from Vietnam and have learned to separate the war from the warriors. Regardless of how you feel about this war, we as Americans have a moral obligation to take care of those who've served. And I think most Americans understand that now. But, you know, with regard to the criticism on the war, you'll see criticisms from both sides of the aisle. Members of Mr. Larson's party, Chuck Hagel, who's a Vietnam vet and a Republican himself, has recently said that there is no real success in Iraq, and it seems as though we're not making progress. Senator John McCain has often been critical of the war in Iraq and often complains about the fact that you can't even drive from the airport to Baghdad without getting blown up. So I think, you know, there's a real problem with metrics right now. We haven't agreed on metrics for success or failure. So things like troop numbers and enemy killed in action are often thrown around, but the bottom line is we've never been able to establish security for the Iraqi people. We've never been able to keep them safe. We've never been able to take care of their families so they can get to work without being blown up. And we've never been able to stop the core elements that fuel an insurgency, which are money, people, and weapons. Because we've never had enough troops on the ground, we've never been able to secure the borders. And there have been a number of mistakes along the way. And you know, this is not an anti-war stance. This is an important military analysis. And in the military, we call it an after-action review. We sit down and say, what went well, what went poorly, and what can we do differently to change the course and improve?
Senator Larson, is it wrong to make those points, to make those kinds of criticisms of what's going on in Iraq?
Well, that's a beautiful thing about America is that we can have that debate. But again, I would disagree with Paul. I do think we are heading in the right direction, and we are seeing tremendous progress. The soldiers that I have visited with that have replaced me since I returned say that it's dramatically different. On our base, Anaconda, we used to get hit by rockets and mortars on nearly a daily basis. They report back that they've gone 3 to 4 months without an attack. So I think we are seen tremendous progress. I think the turnout for the elections demonstrates the success that we are having. On the January 30th vote of this year, a slightly larger percent of Iraqis actually turned out to vote than in our own U.S. presidential election, and that's despite the rockets and the bombs that they faced.
Paul Rykoff, do you think that if public support for the war were not declining, that there would be more support for what you talked about earlier, mandatory funding for veterans to keep up with what you describe as the growing need?
No, I think we could separate the two, and I think that the parties have been able to separate the two. Both Democrats and Republicans have introduced legislation that will affect the welfare of veterans, you know, independent of the criticisms on the war, and I think that's important, especially when so few people in this country are serving. Right now, about less than 1% of the overall American population is serving in Iraq. In World War II, it was about 12%. So what that means is today, most Americans don't know veterans. They don't have that personal connection like they did in past generations, and for many of them, it's really an issue rather than an experience. But there's also a need to take care of our veterans. There has been a tremendous general public push to try to do more for our folks, but the bottom line is we need more than those bumper stickers on the cars. We need action, and for the folks in Washington who say they support the troops, well, it's time for them to put their money where their mouth is, no matter what party they're from.
Senator Larson, are you going to stay in politics and try to carry the message that United for Our Troops was designed to circulate?
Well, absolutely. I'm going to stay active. I'm not seeking re-election to the Iowa Senate, but I'm going to continue to work with our families who have loved ones in the combat zone, families that have lost loved ones in the combat zone, all united for our troops and their mission.
It's interesting, Senator, that you and Paul Rykoff seem to represent the same argument that's going on amongst civilians here in this country within the military itself. How do you think it divides? How many people do you think in the military feel the way you do as opposed to the way Paul Rykoff does?
Oh, I would say the vast majority of those in the military would agree with our philosophy. The troops that I worked with were proud of the work that they were doing. It's a tough mission. You never have to worry about this generation of young people. They'll be able to lead our nation forward. But they're seeing firsthand the progress they're making. And I only wish Americans could have the opportunity to talk to returning soldiers about the successes, about the smiles on the Iraqis' faces, to be out from under the sadistic regime of Saddam Hussein. The estimates are that there's approximately 1 million people in mass graves in Iraq. He was nothing more than a little Joseph Stalin.
And Paul Rykoff, what do you think about the balance of opinion amongst troops that are now in Iraq, or you're not in Iraq? So let me ask you about the veterans then, yeah, who've come home from Iraq.
Well, I served for a year on the front lines in Baghdad, and I think I saw within my unit something that was indicative of what we saw throughout the Army, is that we were all optimistic and we were all supportive, and we're going to complete our phase of the mission as much as possible, but we also saw it getting harder. We saw the flaws in planning at the highest levels affect us on the ground. And I would disagree, 100% with Mr. Larson. We're not making progress in Iraq, and I think the American public understands that, and the first people to understand it were the people in the military. They're dramatically overextended. The divorce rate is doubled. About half our troops in Iraq right now are National Guard and Reserves. About half of them are there for a second time, and it's not sustainable. So I think the real disagreement that started to come about within the military is about how the Bush administration has treated the military. They've really run it into the ground, and it's affected every facet of our lives beyond this mission. So I think that's where there's real discontent that's growing, and that will continue to grow, just like it has in the American population when we don't see results.
All right. On Veterans Day, two veterans with dramatically different views of what's happening in Iraq and what is going to happen next. We're delighted to have both of you with us, and thank you both for your service in Iraq and your continuing concern with the public issues. Paul Rykoff, who's founder and executive director of Operation Truth, Chuck Larson, State Senator Chuck Larson in Iowa, who's founder of United for Our Troops. Thanks to our earlier guests, Chris Bain, Staff Sergeant, now at Walter Reed Hospital, and Paul Hackett, the attorney and now Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Iowa. Good to have all of you with us today on Veterans Day. The armistice that ended World War I went into effect in 1918, 87 years ago to the day. Armistice Day was declared a holiday in 1926, and it was changed to Veterans Day in 1954. With the passing of those many decades, the nature of warfare has changed. In a moment, we'll talk about the evolution of combat on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Allen back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the 87 years since the end of World War I, changes in the nature of warfare have been dramatic. Two areas in which that's most obvious are technology and medicine. Richard Cohn is professor of history and chair of the curriculum in peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He was chief of history for the U.S. Air Force during the 1980s. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on the broadcast.
Tell us a little bit, first of all, about technology since World War I, a war in which, of course, there were an enormous number of casualties.
Well, the technology in the 20th century really was dependent mostly, I think, on rapid-fire weapons and the expansion of the battlefield. The battle space widened in length and width. Battle areas became whole continents, individual battlefields much larger. And, of course, the addition of much more undersea warfare and warfare in the air over both land and sea. And what occurred was a just increasing lethality of the battle space. And you join that with not only rapid-fire artillery and big guns and small arms and machine guns, but the automation involved, the use of bombs, the nuclear weapons, of course, only used twice but threatened to be used. And what you have, it seems to me, is a much quicker, much more rapid, much more dangerous battlefield. People at the end of World War I were talking about the storm of steel. And then when in the last half of the 20th century, increasing automation of sensors and the use of radars, much greater distance to the killing zones. And so it just became a great deal more threatening and dangerous to soldiers, sailors, and airmen and marines of all the nations in high technology, high-tech warfare.
What about medicine?
Well, medicine tried to keep pace with that, of course. It was much more difficult for soldiers to stand this and to put up with battle. We increasingly understood the psychological effects. What was shell shock in World War I became, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome later. So there was the psychological element. There was also the increasing ability to save casualties. For one thing, disease became less of a factor with better public health. There were antibiotics, much less amputation. And so the numbers of wounded to killed increased a lot as we saved more and more lives. You had medical airlift and things of that sort. So I think on the one hand it became more dangerous, and on the other hand there was a greater chance of survival if you were hit as the 20th century moved on.
We're talking with Richard Cohen, who again is a professor of history at North Carolina in Chapel Hill and former chief of history for the United States Air Force. What has been the impact of these changes on the balance of power in the world?
Well, I think what's happened mostly is that the more developed countries, and particularly the United States, have been able to create military forces that are almost unstoppable in a particular battle situation. The use of air power, the use of capital-intensive weapons, sea power to project power overseas, has created an increasing disparity between those great powers that can invest the money and the time to train people and to get this kind of complex synchronized warfare. And as a result, other nations and other groups in ethnic conflict and in insurrectionary situations and in civil wars, still having access to rapid-fire weapons, machine guns, small arms, and so on, have increasingly turned to insurrectionary war, guerrilla war, to try to frustrate the great powers' ability to control areas once they've conquered them. And we've seen that in the last 30 years. Actually, it antedates, of course, the 20th century by a great deal. But you get this disparity, and you sometimes see giants like the United States frustrated greatly by this kind of reaction. It's called asymmetrical war in the Pentagon.
Asymmetrical war is a very interesting idea, and aren't we seeing that now in Iraq? Didn't we see it in Vietnam? Hasn't it proven to be a very difficult thing to overcome? And you can't do it with the kinds of technology that you talked about earlier unless you want to destroy whole cities.
Well, sometimes that technology can be counterproductive. If you want to topple a regime like Saddam Hussein's, that technology can do it much more quickly and much more effectively than in the past. But if you want to control an area of the earth or you want to impose political control, in the end, all warfare is political in a sense. It's shaped by its goals as much as by and even more than it is by its technology. It's shaped by culture and by the internal political situation. And it's been the case that suppressing insurrections and gaining political control is a very complex warfare challenge, and it requires less technology and more sophisticated political strategies and, in fact, large numbers of people.
Back to the conditions of combat on the ground, how would you compare the experience of an American soldier in World War I at the height of combat to the experience of an American soldier in Iraq today?
Well, in World War I, soldiers operated in masses. They went to the attack. They would come out of their trenches and attack, and then they would, near the end of the war, be much more on the move. They could see each other. There were massive artillery bombardments, and they were confronting another army, and it was pretty clear what your side of the line was and what the other side of the line was and what the real dangers were. It was the storm of steel in the air and the need to seize and hold ground. Whereas in Iraq, it seems to me American soldiers are operating in much more in small groups against a much hidden enemy, intermixed with a population, usually in urban areas, that don't stand and fight. And even the process of finding them and of operating outside their safe enclaves are fraught with danger, because so much of the roadways and the towns and the houses are booby-trapped, and so it's a very frustrating kind of war. The same fear is there, but I think the noise and chaos of the World War One battlefield isn't there. It's a much more quiet, but then suddenly very frightening situation.
If you're a soldier, is it really just the same?
Well, of course, we historians are always debating how much things are the same and how much are different. There are elements of it that are very much the same. The cohesion one feels with the units, the sense of mission, the sense of determination, the reliance on the leadership of your non-commissioned officers and your officers, and also the fear. I mean, those things are very much the same.
Professor,
but the external battlefield is different.
We're out of time for that. You talked a bit about the external battlefield at the outset. We'd love to talk to you again. Meantime, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Cohn, professor at North Carolina Chapel Hill, former chief of history for the U.S. Air Force. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderson, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sherman Rimbaugh, managing producer Cameron Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.